tea.
Don't you stay and join us?
Too much to do.
Okay. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Thanks for being here. My name's Rebecca. I'm a PhD here at the center. And my PhD is on printing, print culture in Renaissance Italy. But I'm an art historian as a training, so that's why I'm up here tonight to talk to you about visual culture of the Renaissance and classical tradition. I will first do a lecture part, and then there's the reading that Jane was kind to send you, and etc. But feel free anytime to interrupt, to ask questions. This is very informal and collaborative. Also because the more lecture part of the evening will be based on images. So tell me if you don't see well one of them, they should be fine, but you never know. So so it's how we do that in art history. You look at the images while you talk. So if there's a detail that interests you or something else, we can also comment a bit on the image. So, and another thing that I will do in this respect is to try to show you some of the key images in this sense, the kind of images that could tell you the most about the... I was just explaining the kind sorry. Of... Oh, okay, sorry, we started very on time, so feel free to... just settle in and sign the attendance.
Right. I'm going to have to leave at 8 o'clock. The reason I'm late is I've got a ticket for the concert tonight at the Arts Centre. So
it's a good reason to...
Yeah, I'm meeting my husband and after the interval, so sorry about that.
What's the concert on?
Berlioz, I know that's one. I can't remember. It's the Halle Orchestra.
Oh, actually.
Yeah, it's Mark Elder conducting.
There were a lot of cars around,
yeah.
So I hope this would be a nice start.
Yeah, I wanted to come to this bit.
Just to sum it up briefly, being an art historian, I'm here to you tonight within the course. So there will be loads of images because I'd like to tell you things, but also to show you artworks. So feel free anytime to ask questions or that's nice, that why that and etc. So we can look at closer when you're long here. Unfortunately, at the text because Vasari is kind of like canonical. Text. I don't know if some of you have already heard or read about him, but we will try to read through it, not in a challenging way, why this and why that, but to see what's happening behind the text sometimes, why is there certain things, what could be the reasons, and yes, a bit of context as well, when this work appeared, and so so with respect to the images, I was starting to say, in the slides that you somehow, I don't know how Jane will give you the slides later, I can even send them to you. I've tried to put in red some links, you will see them later, I will point it out to you. Because, yes, some I will show you some famous artworks. But at the same time, I've tried to use also artworks that are in the Barber Institute of Arts. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've been there.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I don't have to convince you that it's a nice museum to visit.
But I'd forgotten about it, so I'm glad you've reminded me.
So go there, visit. It's a tiny collection, it's not that big, but I think it's kind of overlooked because we are so close to London and the other main city museum of Birmingham gets more attention. But please pay it a second visit in this case.
Are the Da Vinci drawings there that are on at the moment?
Yeah, there is something, I don't think it's already open, or because they've opened so many this week, because they've tried to organise something like 15 exhibitions throughout the United Kingdom, so it's kind of tricky to keep up with all of them. But yes, they're doing one, because they actually have a great, just a little detail, great drawings and prints collection. So I'm kind of a fan of that. So they also show them on appointment. So if you want to look at the website and say, oh, there's this one I would like to see, it's not only for researchers and students. You can just book an appointment, write to them. Museums in the UK are a great place because they do that all the time. If you're interested in something and you explain it, and of course you have to behave on the occasion, but it just means not to bring any pens in the study room. But they're really, really keen on showing you things. So it's a great sub collection of the museum. And so to start a bit with the core of the class, visual culture is a broader term to mean artworks, the visual arts like painting, architecture and sculpture. There will be also some other types of artworks, but a bit of a caveat is that it will be mainly the fine arts tonight, because for the purpose of what I want to show you. But don't forget that there's more than that. Mm-hmm. And another little caveat is going to be Western Europe based, because it's what the Renaissance that we study here, it's mostly based on this area. And as a time frame, though, it's kind of broader, and you will see we will start a bit not with immediately the 16th century, everything, or it's already there. We will see a bit something that's previous to that, and try to arrive to the 17th century. So, really to start, if I tell you a classical work of art, something from the antiquity that's been done in the early modern times, in the Renaissance, so in more or less in those times, something that might come up to your mind. I guess, I don't know, the David by Michelangelo, or maybe also some other famous ones, like other by Michelangelo, the Sixtine Chapel. So these big things. But what if I showed you this? This is Villa Madama. So it's in Rome, but back in the time it was really countryside. It's on one of the hills. And it was a private palace of one of the popes back then. And Raphael was not only a painter, he was also an architect. Mm-hmm. And he did this. Unfortunately, he died while supervising the building site.
Sorry.
Hello.
Oh, please. That is terrible.
Sorry, I'll keep on, but I can brief you on the class later on, so feel free just to have your seat. So yes, he unfortunately died while he was supervising the site, but this part that I'm showing you, this kind of like courtyard, semicircular courtyard, it's the part that he actually supervised. And would you say this is a classical work of art, inspired by the classics? Mm-hmm. It has all the orders and the architecture, but please remember the detail. I will use the slide also later, but just focus on the detail of the base of the capital, which is just some architectural parts. It might not look too much antique. It's just a way of building the column, it might seem. But I will come back to this. This is actually another way of doing the antique, of is being inspired by the classics, in the techniques. So how the types of material. This is a bit of a preview, sorry, and a bit of a teaser as well. What about this? This is it's very tiny, something like this.
Wow.
And yes, this is one of the works of art from the Barber Institute. And it's a Flemish sculpture from the Netherlands. Doesn't look like very classical, but if one what they discovered with collecting statuettes from the Roman times, is that there's a huge production of bronze small statues that play with monstrous appearances, putting together pieces that don't make any sense, half human, half beast. And mostly they were decorative and used as a furniture, so lamps, little appliques, these kind of things. And they survived and they became collected. So this could be a way of doing the antique, the classical. What about this? I don't know if you've seen it already, but it's called Melancholia 1, the first, I don't know, by this printmaker painter from Nuremberg, Albrecht Dürer. And it doesn't look too much classical, because there's an angel, the atmosphere is very somber, does not match to remind you of Roman times. But this is actually a very complex print, and the subject is somehow still debated, because there is no clear way of interpreting it. The painter didn't leave any writings on this, and he wanted to use symbols that had roots in the classical past. The weird solid figure. It's a specific figure that was studied in ancient mathematics. Also, the square that you see on the side, it's supposed to reflect a divine presence, sort of using maths figures in a symbolic way, and that is something as well that the people in the early modern times saw that the ancients were doing. So not only the serene Olympic ancient times, there's a lot that was going on, and they started to uncover and to be interested in. So what I will try to show you is how they were faced with a very broad set of tools and themes, and there were some key sort of threads that shaped the relationship between art and the classical tradition. But there are also threads that are kind of considered minor, but they are not, because they were still part of the interest of Renaissance people towards the classical times. And sometimes they were in the same ancient writings. So it's a way to be reminded that you always sort of find what you are looking for, or that you want to find something that to rearrange in a certain way. So,
wow.
As I said to you, the Renaissance in visual art doesn't start immediately on the 1st of January in 1501. There's a lot before that. Things continue. So also keep in mind that there's the relationship with the classical tradition is a way to look at the art in this time. So it's not the only one. It's a prominent one. So. And already in the early 14th century, they were starting to think differently about how to paint. And I don't know if you know of Giotto. He's one of the main painters of this turn of these 2 centuries, the 13th and 14th. And this chapel, which is a devotional work in itself, displays some revolutionary sort of features. I don't know, but what if you've seen something of medieval art? Have you seen a lot of blue skies? They're usually gold.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yes, that's good.
This is a bit tricky, because in that time blue was very, very expensive. So it was also a way to say, well, the patron, I got the money. I can afford this. I can afford the Giotto, and I can afford tons of blue. But at the same time, it's not anymore the eternal skies of gold. It's a more human sky. And at the same time, the figures are set in the space. Some are turning at the back to us, mm-hmm. so it's a way to say that there's a three-dimensional space within the scene, and there's a bit of little attempts at trying to paint architecture as well. So it doesn't start all of a sudden, and it starts with a renewed interest in the culture of the classical times that's more broadly described, and especially with respect to intellectual history or literary history, as humanism, mm-hmm. something that already in the early 14th century was happening in little university cities throughout Western Europe. And the brief introduction to hand out to you this essay, which is part of a companion to humanism, but it's written by two art historians, so you will I've thought that it's a nice way to sort of tie in with the rest of the classes, because this is the most intellectual side of the relationship with the classical tradition. So, so really, in this time, they were thinking differently things. But in the 15th century, a big way to engage with the classical tradition was not through painting or through architecture, sculpture, but with coins. But this is actually in the wrong way, with coins. This is, and it's a slide to show you that there's a great, also next to prints, a great coin collection in the Barber Institute. So if you can see, this is a Roman coin, and this is a 15th century coin. Mm-hmm. It's actually called a medal because it had no currency value, mm-hmm. and it's slightly bigger. It's like this, but it's the same. It's the same thing: a profile of a ruler, and in this case, we have an emblem, so an allegorical animal that's connected to this Leonello d'Este. It's a lynx.
Because he blindfold.
Yes.
Is that to keep it quiet?
Probably. I don't know how they kept lynxes, but they had them. This guy had them, because when you identified yourself in an animal for, I don't know, public relations reason in this way, sometimes they kept them. In Florence, in Palazzo Vecchio, the emblematic animal of the city is the lion, and they kept live in cage lions behind Palazzo Vecchio. I don't know how those poor creatures lived, but they showed them to diplomats because it was their sort of like, I don't know, the coat of arms of the city come alive. And I guess that the blindfold is connected more to the allegorical meaning attached to the lynx.
Yes.
Great sight that can see so far that probably you can see also what you, not with material eyes, also the spiritual side. But yeah, so it's Leonello d'Este was a marquis in north of Italy, and this is actually done by a painter, Pisanello, and these coins were used for diplomatic gifts when they signed treaties and so. But it was also based on the taste for collecting Roman coins. They had huge collections of coins because they were easy to transport and to exchange, but also they were valuable in themselves. They were of gold, of precious metals, so there was a kind of like a practical side. But it was also because via coins you can get information about the classics, because you can see the aspect of a Roman emperor, information about when he got into power, when he died. Sometimes, as in this one, you have buildings. This is the Arapaces. So they were also used by learned people to reconstruct Roman history. Mm-hmm. So you see that there's a kind of overlapping of things. There's the sort of diplomatic level, the attached to value and to expression of wealth, but also the cultural side. And this actually influenced a lot some ways of painting. And you can see, this is a portrait of the same guy, and it's really inspired by that kind of statuesque, very still way of doing a portrait, a profile, so not a full front or a three quarters. And again, there's people have studied the types of clothes and flowers, so again with a bit of allegory and symbolism going behind that. So you can see that not only the same people could do different things, and not only painting and sculpture and architecture, but that the engaging with the classics meant that you did new things. You were able to produce new things. You challenged yourself as an artist to produce your own art. And this is one of the sometimes overlooked ways of how this artist engaged with the classics is not only they didn't copy them. Sometimes yes, and we will see how and in what sense. But they were challenging themselves. They were measuring themselves against the ancients. The ancients were the best of the best, as in the humanistic tradition, that people who could give you the best examples in how to be a virtuous person and also to create great works of art. But you had to challenge yourself. You had to create new things. You were a modern. So it's not a hierarchical approach. They were very aware that could do great things. And if you read the prefaces, it's actually a lot about measuring yourself against nature, against the ancient, but especially what's called the third part is they did something that was nobody had seen before, something new. And yes, this was a way of also introducing the fact that classical tradition, which classical tradition? We've seen that this portrait is very realistic, it's very lifelike, and the classics are a huge category. There's the Egyptian tradition, there's the Jewish tradition, the Roman, the Greek, and in this case it's more the Roman, because Romans did a much more realistic way of portraying people compared to the Greeks that have a penchant for being much more idealistic. And this to show that things were really used to create new things and kept on even through the century. We are at the end of the 15th century. We've mentioned coins as a very easy way that they had in their hands to see the antiques. But if you think of classical painting, what do you think was available then? Was there Ercolano, Pompeii? No, they weren't discovered.
No.
It's the 18th century that they discovered them. Mm-hmm. In these times, one of the key references in painting was the Domus Aurea. The Domus Aurea is Emperor Nero's palace in Rome, close to the Colosseum. Nobody knew of that. They knew that it existed, but they didn't found it because it was below level, below ground level. A shepherd, really, a tale like a shepherd boy fell into a hole and they discovered that there were caves with paintings. All the artists wanted to look at them, Raphael, Michelangelo, they sort of fought to get access to those. And these are grottesque. Grotta, in Italian, is a cave. So it's just to say these are paintings we found in caves.
Wow. Amazing.
So it's just a neutral term. Mm-hmm. It became later this way of painting with decorative and in inventive details. But first it was like, wow, we discovered Roman paintings. And as you can see, it was really all the rage. Mm-hmm. And Raphael's workshop, this is a part of the Vatican Palace, the Lodge. They are on different layers, and on some of them there's biblical scenes, but the top one, come back, okay, the top one is this decorative, very, very Roman kind of doing painting. This slide is also to tell you that while we're looking at the Romans, the Greeks, and etc., they were still doing a lot of religious art. It's not disappeared. You've seen tons of references to God in Vasari. It wasn't that immediately they ditched the Christian religion to just look at the Romans. So as a brief reminder, because sometimes that gets kind of overlooked. What about sculpture? The sculpture on the on your right is the Apollo Belvedere. And it was known already in the 1430s, 1450s. But it is late in the century, in the 15th century, people start to queue and go to the person who discovered that in their own garden in Rome to see and do sketches. This one on the left, they discovered it in 1506.
Wow.
Because they knew it existed. It's in Pliny. So people read ancient authors said, oh my God, we've lost so many good works of art. But they managed to find some. And it was mind-blowing for them, because it's also a way of saying, well, they didn't lie. This existed. And that was all the creation. It's a bit like the gold fever, that everybody was digging in their own garden and they found so much stuff. Because with years, with centuries, it literally just became piled in the ground, so it didn't go anywhere. Sometimes they reused the materials that you'll see, but it was still there. And it became as an inspiration for people like Michelangelo. Don't look at the unfinished part of it, because it's due to the fact that it's a very complicated, it's more than 40 years that it took to realize the tomb for Julius II, and it didn't even go well in the end. It's completely different from the original design, so it's a very complicated story. But this kind of if you think of David, which is very serene, very symmetric, and this is much more this kind of thing, like the passion, the urge, that's also in the antique. And another brief reminder is, again, that they were starting to dig because they looked different at things. This is the Camposanto in Pisa, which is actually like in the same square of the Leaning Tower and the Dome and the Cathedral. And it's a cemetery where they kept all the Roman sarcophagi. But it's just that they weren't looking at in the same way at these Roman pieces until the 14th century. But things were already there, so they started to dig, to look at things differently. It's a bit of a change of perspective rather than a sudden discovery that something existed and had been lost. So I'm trying to remind you that it's really important to think what was available to them to shape their relationship with the antique. And this is a later etching that depicts Villa Tivoli. And another way to look at the antique that was, again, sort of rediscovered was via text. And some classical texts described Roman villas. These villas connected to land with wealthy owners, but they were the place where they retired themselves and they had their personal life. And they became the model onto which shaped this the kind of Italian villa where you have an open-air museum and a garden. How much that means for European visual culture to have villas with gardens and shaped in a certain way. It's this thing. It's these are actually, I cannot remember right now, but Cardinal d'Este collected very famous and priceless works of art from the Roman times and just display them in his villa, because that's how you did it. That's how they did, and you could do that again. Another way is, yes, this is a technical way to look into the antique, how to retrieve and reconstruct orders, because it's not that you can put anything in any order, and that's okay. But they've tried to compare different writings of architecture, mainly Vitruvius, but not only. There's descriptions in historical Roman accounts that describe architecture, and they've compared them, and so it was many, many years where architects just gathered and published the treatises saying, oh, this is the way to do the Corinthian order, no, this is the other way, you do the Attic in this way. It was a huge debate, and several books were published. They were trying to not only use that for their own architecture, but also to study that. So it's another kind of looking at the antique in a scientific way, sort of, as something that it's different from you, that you can use for your own work, but also something to look in the objective way, in a study way. The text from Roman times, they were used a lot. This is the kind of like the humanistic kind of thread as a source for depicting and learning about Roman history, but history as a way of depicting values. Just as an example, the guy on the right with the purple robe is Cicero, so the rhetorician and the someone who wouldn't bend again in the face of power. And there's other famous Roman Republican men here. And it's a precise choice in this time when Florence was still, let's say, quote-unquote, a republic. It wasn't still a time where the Medici said, well, you know what, we've kept up the appearances, but it's actually our court, our town. It's still a time when, under Lorenzo Magnifico, they presented themselves at the Republic of Florence. So they wanted to depict the examples. It's a key word. It's an example. We can be good. We can be the best rulers, virtuous rulers, for the sake of our populace. And so we are going to look at the ancients, who were the founders of the Roman Empire. So who better than them? Yes. So, yes, this is another example. It's not only Florence that does it. There's tons and tons of historical depiction in this sense, this time, Perugino, and you can see also some prudence and fortitude. There's still Christian culture behind it. It's about virtue. This is the virtue in history, but there's also virtue in non-history, in the eternal times. That's Christian virtue. You don't have to forget it. Okay, myths. Myths are complicated things because in the Greek mythology has no holy scriptures. There's poetry, but sometimes they don't coincide. So it's tricky. Where does truth lie? So they started to study it, again, as like in architecture, and say, well, you know what? Neptune and the River Tiber, they have these shapes, these... attributes, disappearances. So they published things where they described all the possible ways that the myths presented themselves. And this is actually becomes like a textbook for this, imagining quando l'esposizione degli dei antichi. It becomes textbook for painters and artists, because it's a very, very handy book where you have tons of illustrations, all the quotations where you can refer and say, oh, I'm just going to do Neptune as the poet so-and-so and not as the other poet. And so it's also a publishing phenomenon because it becomes very successful. This and others, there's a work on iconology, how to create symbols based in part on the classical tradition. And so, yes, we can see that this is not only Italy. It's not only the Mediterranean. It's north of Europe as well. They become so fascinated that even people like Gotsius and Gossard, who probably didn't have any close marbles or architecture from the Roman times, started to depict these things. is weird. This is monsters. Why monsters and the antique? This is so interesting. First of all, the greatest philosopher of all ancient times, the philosopher and quote-unquote Aristotle, wrote on monsters, not only on other things like physics, ethics, on monsters too. He was a man of science. And so, I mean, the classic had an interest in monsters, so it's worth looking at them. But these two specific ones are actually from Pliny, because Pliny, in his Natural History, described the populations of the world. He didn't have probably a clue about these populations, because he described people with giant ears, people that had just one big feet and sheltered under that during nighttime, and these weird types of things. But it is something. It was still popular in the Middle Ages, in the sense that some traditions, some themes from the ancient survived. So again, not to say that something disappeared completely, but to say that they are looking at things, combining a scientific approach, and still, I mean, this is in a classical text, so we are going to later see scientists saying, well, if you have no hard truth, no hard evidence, no experimentations, you can't say that. But still in these times, the classics are so powerful that they say, well, we're going to include them because Aristotle and Pliny say so. This is a very broad generalization. They weren't so supine towards the ancient. But they had this, they looked at them with such curiosity that they used their examples. And this meant that they produced works of art that are, like the Melancholia here, that are so strange to us that we lost their meaning. This is, if the Melancholia one is kind of interpreted, this one, nobody really knows what it means already, yet. Because, yes, they say it's a dream of Raphael, so the dream of an artist, what you can conjure up with your mind. But what's a ship in there? There's a basilisk. There's a dragon, there's a philosopher maybe. So it's still a way to look at the classic, because it's using combining symbols. I mentioned to you the Egyptian tradition. It is probably not the canonical classic, but they were so interested. There's a whole area in the Vatican Palace that's the Egyptian rooms, because they were interested in Isis, in Horus, in these things that they started to read about. It was still the antiquity for them. And they reinterpreted against Plato, against Christianity. So they tried to make sense of a word that was very far from them. They also discovered in this way hieroglyphs. And sorry if I'm pronouncing that badly, because it's a word I struggle with. And they looked at hieroglyphs as a visual thought, as thought in visual form. So not only the stork is a stork, the sphinx is a sphinx, but together they mean something else. A lot of they produced works that are really close to the Egyptian hieroglyphic style, but also this symbolic creation, summing up things of different type. It's part of that. Part of the mythology, of the attributes of myths, but also of these ancient Egyptian roots. They also believe that the culture of the Egyptian then passed to the Greeks. So for them, they saw everything in sort of evolution. And I think it's what we read also in Vasari. There's an evolution. Everything is connected. So yeah, that was again an example. So these were sort of way to show you what they had in front of them, how they thought about the ancient one, depending on what was available. But what they started also to do, not only to produce work of art, but to collect them and to create these things that would become museums in a very broad way. But collecting is operating a selection into reality. You're choosing this and not that. And they chose to collect antiquities, small statuettes, coins, but they put them together with their contemporary works. This is a painting from Isabella Gonzaga's studiolo. So, Isabella Gonzaga was the wife of the Gonzaga Duke in Mantua, but she was also an Este. So, these are places where they put a lot of focus on being cultured, even if you were just a ruler. And so she was really passionate about art personally, and I think it's a very nice example of a woman that knew what she liked, and she had the power. She had her own money to buy these things because she was an Este, so she said, well, okay, we're both important. And the studio was a room, it literally means tiny room, tiny study room in Italian, where you had the most precious items you had, your possessions, your valuables, and where you retired yourself to study, to think about a work, also with the Bible, but also with these types of artworks. And in this case, it's a contemporary commission. She said to 3-4 artists of her time, well, I like the ancients, but I also like you. You're the artist of our time, so you're very famous. I'm going to ask you to do classical-inspired works. And as you can see, there's no myths here. This is the Battle of Love and Chastity, and the Parnassus. They're not straightforward myths or episodes from the antiquity, but they use classical statues to model the bodies, and they use allegorical ways of portraying a history. And it becomes very, very popular as a thing. The studiolo also, her brother was the ruler of Ferrara at the same time, had the same thing. And also in Mantua, her husband and later Gonzaga rulers amassed such a wealth of art that it was really a collection that people started to visit from all over Europe. Unfortunately, from the early 17th century, they went bankrupt and became heirless, and sort of the city was also later on conquered by other. Then it fell under the influence of greater powers like Spain, and so they had to sell it. But okay, so this was not. I'm going out of the presentation. Oh, this is the wrong one. Sorry. To show you something that is in Hampton Court.
Ah.
This is the same. This is the Gonzaga. Comes from the Gonzaga collection, and it's the Triumphs of Caesar by Mantegna. There, they were exhibited in the exhibition of Mantegna and Bellini at the National Gallery. They're now going to Berlin, but in a year time, I suggest you to go to Hampton Court and see them, because they're amazing. They're huge. They're 2.50 meters each side, because they were these panels that they had to work as a tapestry as well. So this is story of collecting gives you a look on how this exemplarity of the classics becomes such a widespread European phenomenon that Charles I decides to buy these. He buys also Raphael's original drawings for the tapestry of the Vatican. They are now in the V&A. And actually, there was an exhibition on his collection last year. And if you happen to have a look at the catalogue, it's amazing, because there's a lot of, not only, but a lot of classical art or classical-inspired art, because it was the way to self-fashion yourself as a ruler as well. I'll go back to these. Sorry, I just need to get back here. Sorry, this is a very weird. Okay. But these are a way to look at the antique if you're a ruler, if you collect, and etc. But as a painter, there's other ways to engage with the antiquity. One of them is called exemplar. Exemplar means examples, but it's a kind of technical term to mean quotations. So in this case, Botticelli decided to paint a triumphal arch at the back of his story of Lucretia. That's really an homage to the triumphal arch of... Sorry, the caption disappeared. On the left, there's Constantine Arch, close to the Colosseum, and Septimus Severus one, which is in the Fori, a bit towards the Capitol. So they looked at things and said, well, I'm just going to make a quote because I want to show that I'm a learned painter, but also because I think this is fitting to the story I want to tell. Again, the thing I was telling you, the techniques, is that this is all brick. As you can see, even behind the Y there, there's brick. But Raphael looked at texts that said that in certain buildings, the Romans just grinded marble to a powder and used that as plaster to save money, but also as a way of doing something different than just using marble all the time, because it has a different effect visually. And so, I mean, he's not only doing an architecture that's inspired in the columns and etc., but also in the techniques. So they were reading very carefully into the text to measure themselves. Yes, yeah, sorry, this is again mythology as a subject. You want to you want to paint something, and who knows, what can I fancy today? Something about Heracles. But, I mean, this is still Heracles. And Hercules. And in this case, it's German dress. It's German clothing. Lucas Cranach was the first big painter that adopted the Reformation. He was very close to Luther and Melanchthon. He did illustrations to the first Lutheran Bible. And so I guess that they didn't really like using Roman inspired things. They liked still the subject because that was a common past. But again, choosing a classical subject, you can do that very differently. This is a very subtle way of doing the classical tradition, of reviving it. So this guy, Lorenzo Lotto, was a painter, and especially in the areas, the minor areas of northern Italy, like Bergamo, Brescia, so not the big cities. And that means that we don't know the names of the people he depicted. But if we look closely at the drawing, there's also the quotation under it, and the woman is about to kill herself with a knife. And that's Lucrezia from ancient Roman history, a noble woman that unfortunately, I'm sorry, this is kind of like a... it's. The Roman history is full of these things as well, was raped by the son of the Roman king, and she said, my virtue is being tainted, I'm gonna commit suicide. And that fact escalated things, and they got rid of kings and so on and so. But by using that, which is one of the only identifiable things, I mean, this woman was called Lucrezia. And she wanted to present themselves as a virtuous woman, not probably ready to kill herself, but to say, I might be from the province, I might be from the countryside, but I'm a virtuous woman, and I'm a good housekeeper. And so, but again, it's a subtle way to use the antique. In this case, to the service of the patron. Here we go again to the... relationship with powers, and this is Peter Paul Rubens. It's a great painter for the influence, for the impact that he had. He can be seen as sort of like the chain that links some developments in southern Europe and the north. He was very learned, he could read Latin, so it's a different type of artist. But at this time, where early, mid-17th century artists were learned and wealthy people, could be also wealthy people. So he read Latin, he read Greek, and had books on iconology, on the book on myths that I showed you earlier, so to use in the workshop. But he was very, very well acquainted with the rulers in his time. And this is a huge cycle devoted to Maria de' Medici. Was a Medici, but she became Queen of France. I think she's the mother of Louis the 13th. So, and she had this huge commission of the story of her life as a holder of power. Depicting in terms that, I mean, they're really paying homage to the antique. There's gods and goddesses of water on your right. There's a winged creature with two trumpets. That's fame, victory as well. So, yes, they are in contemporary clothes, probably also to show that they had beautiful satin silver dresses. But also they're still using the language of the antiquity to say that they're in line with the power of the ancients. There's also this thing. I'm sorry to jump a bit in time. This is early 16th century, and it's a massive print. It's actually 36 sheets, almost 200 woodblocks. So woodcut is a type of print where you use a woodblock and you carve it and then you print it. And imagine, you need 200 pieces of wood to print this thing. It's massive. And if I can do that again, I want to show you this. A copy of it, since it's print, it's in several places. I'm going to show you here because if it all... No, it doesn't. I'll do this way then. Sorry. It's so big that we have to look very close to see everything that is happening. If we look at the image, I will go back to the slides. It's like a triumphal arc, still very Roman, blah, blah, blah. But if we look close, I mean, there's so much thing happening. And this doesn't look that much Roman or antique. As a first impression, it's really a reuse. There are some precedents as well. I don't know if you've seen it, the Trajan column in Rome, which is a huge column with history scenes all over it, and it's more or less this kind of battles and armies facing each other. But it's not the same style, and it's not in scenes like that, like this. So I'm just trying to say that. Yes, that it's a very creative way of using some vocabulary, some scenes, some values attached to the antiquity to depict your wealth, your position, your aspirations as well. Because this guy was one of the... Germany was divided, but there were elective princes, so he was one of the leading princes of Germany, and he had big aspirations to be the leading one. Just to go back to this. Yes, so this last couple of slides are also a way of introducing you to the text that we're going to read, or the discussion we can have, and etc. Again, a lot of the engagement with the classicity is about how patrons and how holders of powers wanted to present themselves. And so, as a bit of a preview, at the same time that Vasari wrote this, they were building something called the Uffizi. The Uffizi as a building, it was meant to host the magistracies of the Florentine dukedom. So Palazzo Vecchio, it was part of the private apartments, part of diplomatic headquarters, but the Uffizi, it was all the magistracies. It later became also the place for the collections, but it's there. So there's offices, there's state craft, that is the state affairs at the same time as collections. And collections that are the antique, there's a huge, huge collection of classical statues in the Uffizi. Sometimes you just go there, of course, because you don't have a lifetime to spend in that place. But you look at the paintings, but there's an entire level of it that's just dedicated to statues. Because they were doing everything at the same time. It's not isolated in time as a thing. Art was part of a bigger part of the society. And the last thing before we can go through our break, so as to go back to the title, visual culture. So the relationship with power can be considered as part of the visual culture, because it's in our streets, in our cities. Think of the Bank of England, if you've ever seen it. Mm-hmm. It's a Greek temple. Mm-hmm. The Capitol in Washington, mm-hmm. it's a Greek temple. Mm-hmm. Roman as well, but in this case the Romans, they said, well, we like Greek architecture, we're just going to do the same. So yes, so it's still part of what we see, and we are now kind of looking at it more critically, like why just the Roman and the Greeks, classics, there's so much more than that, and why should we use just the past as a reference? We are in a different time. We use so many buildings now are just glass and cast iron, but still, until the early 19th century, and I mean also later than that, still the antiquity had this big value of speaking of power, speaking of munificence. Munificence is the kind of like generosity of power holders of supervising onto their subjects and citizens. So it's all at the same time. It's the Uffizi, the collection, at the same time as the magistracies and the offices. And visual culture is also details and symbols. One of the they call them heraldic animals, the symbolic animals of the royal family, is the lion. But I don't think that the lion is a very British born kind of animal. It's the same animal of the Swedish crown. But I'm more sure about the Swedish crown, so I'm sorry, I just mentioned also the British one, because the Swedish used until the mid-16th century the bear as a heraldic animal. They were the bear of the north, because, yes, bears are much more likely to be found there, and it's considered the king of the forest in medieval times. But then the classics gained so much power, so much cultural power, that they said, well, you know what? We're just going to present ourselves as the lions of the north. Still now, the Swedish royal family, it's called the lions of the north. Mm. And they don't have lions. It's just like how you use that to present yourself, to see life and to act in your... Like they looked at virtuous men. They also looked at symbols to present yourself in the world. So, yeah, it's also a way to... I hope that you can also look at things differently in this way. There's not only the antique. There's not only the classical tradition. I repeat that. There's much more than that. But art can help us to look at things differently in this way. So, but I guess it's our deserved break, and so you can go to your concert as well.
Sorry. I wish I could stay. It's really interesting.
I'm sure you get the slides and everything. Or if you need anything else, just ask James.
It's called in Sicily. Is it Monreale? With the bikini girls and
drawings. Oh yes, no, it's Armerina. It's a mosaic in Armerina.
Yeah, right in the centre. I mean, was that not known? When you said,
Sicily was really under
the rest of it, but
undervisited. I don't know how to express that. They didn't look. It's a different period of time. It's more the 18th century where they discover things in Naples. But wait a minute, probably all south of Italy has other things that they started to learn. They had these things, except that they didn't have others. So yes, bikini girls of Admarina. It's just later.
Yeah, because they're just amazing, aren't they? And I thought, were they just? It was lay there undiscovered, I think, didn't it?
I think it was still underground because a lot of stuff just becomes when you've just done when buildings go unpopulated, it just ruin and ground just piles up. So it's the 18th century archaeological kind of. I remained in the before 1700s kind of limits of the Renaissance Centre, but yeah, you're right.
You mentioned that the blue paint was far more expensive. Why? What was it?
So blue painting can be done with two pigments. One pigment is azurite, and that's from a mineral that you can find in Europe very well.
Yes.
So it's not as expensive. The other one is
Afghanistan.
They still use Afghanistan as a source, so they have to rely on merchant
handling. It's just one thing, one country.
Yeah.
Of all the world, it's only available in Afghanistan.
It's Afghanistan as part of India. I don't know if you've ever seen it's stone, but it's all consistent with gold and other impurities.
Yeah.
So the Afghanistan is the purest. When you need to grind it, you need to be the purest in that sense. And there's a lot of the painter I showed you, the unknown woman. Had one of his left in his will, a piece of lapis lazuli for his heirs. So priceless. He didn't own any furniture. There's one of the pebbles there, so we can just have something from as well.
Bye.
Bye. Enjoy.
Hello.
Why did you be here?
Oh, yeah, I was thinking
there's two other people to go in if you couldn't take me off.
No, I'm absolutely fine. It was just very bad.
Yeah, but it's not
very
bad.
There's
traffic
coming
in.
Amazing world. It is an amazing world.
Yeah.
And when they were struggling to survive physically, they could still come up with this.
I know.